Hi, and welcome to Outrageous, our weekly podcast where we talk about culture, media, politics, race, and everything in between. I'm Chris in New York City, and yet again, I'm joined by my two very best friends, Jason in D.C.
Hello there.
And Trisha in L.A.
Hi.
Hi, guys. I wanted to start off, because I was listening to the podcast from last week, and Jason was, like, genuinely befuddled at Trisha, your hatred of Ben Affleck. So I just feel like you can explain to him why you don't like Ben Affleck. So what's the deal?
Why are you hating on Ben, Trisha?
I can't even explain it. I have Ben Affleck on screen. As a performer, I just don't find him particularly compelling. I will admit that I think he probably makes good movies. People seem to enjoy them, but I don't remember them. I've always enjoyed Matt Damon more, but now that he's revealed himself to be like a weird racist of some sort, or just at least behind in his thinking, I now enjoy him less. So I think that the key to all of this is I need less information about my performers.
All performers.
Now, can I take a moment to say, so what? As a person, I don't know much about Ben Affleck. I was very disappointed. Did you hear the whole mini scandal about how it was revealed through that Henry Louis Gates series that his ancestors were slave owners and that he actually requested to suppress that information and they did agree to suppress it. So I certainly lost respect for him as a person. I do find him compelling as an actor, and I also think I've seen at least two movies he's directed and starred in, and I thought they were both very good movies.
What were they?
The Town. I was going to say The Wood, The Hood, The Town.
You don't even know what it's called. Wow.
No, it's good. And Argo.
I never saw Argo, and I especially despise The Town. I really do. You know why? I despise The Town?
Why?
Because I hate when you take a movie with, like, a white criminal, and then you romanticize him to the point where he's, like, some sort of, like, noble hero. And then all I kept thinking in the movie was, damn, if this was a black criminal, people want him to get killed. I'm supposed to feel sympathy for you? You're a thief. I had no space for him. You know, it was just wrong. You know, sometimes that happens. You know, sometimes you're watching a movie and you know you're just not, they haven't sold you on the world and you're just done. Like, you know, it's like, it happens. Like, mobster movies are like that for me.
That's why I can't deal with mobster movies, because, you know, like, the morals are, like, upended. Like, I'm sort of like, oh, wait, so, first of all, I can never really get it. I can never really hold plots in my head that are completely revolve around moving around drugs and or money for drugs. I'm just always like, well, who am I rooting for? Like, the law enforcement? Or, like, you move the drugs successfully. Like, I applaud that. Like, I'm not certain where I am on this.
Yeah, I'm always really conscious that you're involved in, like, heinous crimes on some level. So can't ever go there.
I have two words for you. I have two words for you. American Gangster, which I think does such a good job of showing the complexity of the police and of, you know, who would ultimately become the defense attorney and the, you know, the gangster himself. Like, I thought that movie
Denzel
did a
Washington.
Good job of...
I think so too. That was better. It wasn't sort of like glorifying the criminal element per se.
Right. Can I share really quick? I've been dying to tell you guys what happened yesterday. So, you know, I endorsed American Idol a couple of weeks ago. So American Idol's over. They picked the American Idol, but the runner-up, who I was really rooting for, is this black girl from Mississippi. And they mic'd in front of her face, and they asked her about LGBT issues, and she fumbled the ball so badly out of the gate. You know, just basically, she doesn't agree with the lifestyle and church, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So this is, like, vaguely related to the story I'm going to tell you. True story. So I'm walking down the street, and there's, like, these ladies sitting on a bench, and they were, like, handing out, like, Jesus stuff. I didn't realize what it was, but one blew out of this woman's hand, so I picked it up and handed it back to her. And she hands to me, like, oh, no, you keep it. And I was like, and I said to her, no, I'm sorry, I'm gay, I'm happy with it, and I actually love everybody. So she takes the flyer back as if to say, oh, well, we're not about that, so never mind. And I kept it moving. I was laughing because I was like, you really can't get behind that? I'm happy with myself, and I love everybody. She's like, no, I'm out.
Controversial. Very controversial position you stated.
She's like, that's not my Christianity. That's not what I know.
Love everybody? What are you talking about? That's crazy.
What
crazy
is that supposed to mean? Oh, crazy talk.
I heard about the American Idol thing. Yeah, I heard about the American Idol. I was like, oh dear, honey. There goes your album sales.
I know. Because you know who spends money on music sung by big black divas? Gay men. Hey, so, yep. Bye.
I thought that. I was like, later.
Bye, LaPortia.
I know. It's over, honey. I was like, no one's going to be buying your stuff.
Given that we are here to talk, why don't we start talking? So, okay. Jason, I'm going to let you go first.
Okay, so I listened to the Back to the Future or Back to the Past episode 4, that Chris posted, which, as he very eloquently stated, we recorded last summer. And at that time, I had introduced this topic of whether it was in the interests of the African-American community to pool its resources in a geographic area, which you guys actually then named Black Lannis, which now that's what I call it because I just love that name. I was talking about that episode with a friend of mine, and she said, oh, I just heard this other podcast episode about a real place that's kind of like that, Soul City, North Carolina. So I listened to that podcast, and I had never heard of Soul City, and it was really fascinating, and I'm just going to very briefly summarize, which is that in 1969, Floyd McKissick, who was a civil rights leader and director of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, he proposed this planned community called Soul City in North Carolina. It was funded. This project did get off the ground. It was funded by HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And it was one of three model city projects, you know, trying to, basically, cities were not pleasant places to live in at the time. You know, you had white flight, and of course a lot of resources went with white people, and so you had people of color and poor people stuck in cities that all of a sudden had their resources taken away from them. And so people didn't know what to do, and one thing that HUD decided to do was see if they could fund new cities being built. And my understanding from the podcast was that most of these cities were built like right next to other cities, so they were kind of leveraging existing infrastructure. But the idea of Soul City was really to be, you know, a black city, a brand new city built on what had been farmland in North Carolina for black people to start their own businesses and that kind of thing. And it was really fascinating. You know, Floyd McKissick got some really tough questions, like, your movement is advocating for integration. Aren't you kind of retreating to separation? It was definitely a very capitalist vision. He ended up, I found this part really interesting, supporting Richard Nixon in that election because Nixon believed that capitalism could solve all problems. And one of Nixon's things was like, well, if black people don't have it good enough, let's help black people start businesses. And that spoke to Floyd McKissick. So it's a really fascinating story. It did not get very far. It was not ultimately successful. There are kind of different sides to it. Some would say that it just wasn't, you know, created very well, that there wasn't, you know, you had to bring industry to attract residents, but you had to have residents who could be a workforce to attract industry, and so that chicken and egg problem never got off the ground. Jesse Helms and other lovable racists in North Carolina certainly took aim at it. So it's hard to say whether there was a problem internal or external or both, but I think once again I would say, while it seems like it to me, it was a really compelling vision, there wasn't really the capital ultimately invested to make it successful. So I guess what, without being redundant, the question I want to pose to both of you, you know, McKissick had come to the conclusion that integration was not going to lead to better outcomes for black people. And I am here in 2016, and I look across the country and think that while there's been advancement, there's certainly a black middle class, there are black people who have, you know, attained wealth. By and large, I don't see a path to significant equity for black people on a large scale without some geographic concentration to build institutions and wealth building mechanisms for African Americans. And when I say that, I don't think it needs to be capitalistic. It could be socialist, but that there's, you know, some capital there to build upon. I'm posing, I guess, kind of a similar question again, now that we know that there actually has been a historical version of it, now that we've had some time since we last discussed it and we just posted it. I'd love to hear whether you two have completely come around and will be helping me found Black Lannis.
The Jason, the answer is no. No. I'm afraid not. You know, in listening to the podcast and listening to you from last summer, and I asked this, I think, in the original recording, I'm not certain what this is going to do. We put all these black people in one area, and we're asking those black people are going to recreate a certain society. But well, I'm not certain what this would look like. Why are we doing this? We're putting all the black people together in a single area, and they're going to build, what, schools that work suddenly, or a legal system that works? Like, it's still America.
Well, you know, that's what's interesting about. I mean, this is, I have to say, Jason, it's really great that you brought this back up, because I listened to the podcast about Soul City, and what I thought was intriguing about it was its inherent practicality, which is the idea that we have crafted cities and shaped cities before, and that you, with a certain amount of intentionality and city planning, what was intriguing about Soul City was the idea that you could learn from the mistakes that had been constructed in other places, Chris. And more so that you, if you didn't make it race, if you didn't make it about sort of separation of the races, because eventually he had to, McKissick had to agree to that the city was going to be open.
Right.
But essentially the question would be what white person is going to be joining a group of black people. So in some sense it remains segregated, like white communities that just sort of create situations where the segregation happens without sort of malicious intent, I guess, if you want to say. It passively happens. I think you could lobby for that now. You could say that you are trying to craft a city with a certain set of values and a certain ideology, and you can ask people to opt into that experience.
Well,
wouldn't even need it to be racial.
Why would that necessarily include people of color and automatically exclude white people? So Trisha says, what white person will want to move into a community built for or by black people? And I want to just point at gentrification everywhere. It's like, why wouldn't white people want to move there?
That's not the point. No, what I'm saying is when they were constructing the city, there was a certain intentionality about how it was going to be designed and the values that it was going to attempt to put into practice.
And what are those values?
They weren't explicit at the time.
Well,
when McKissick sort of crafted it, right? There were these things that he said we wanted to learn from the way that urbanization had gone wrong, right? And so he wanted to create a space where there would be black industries. Because essentially, I think what he wanted to do was he wanted to prove that it was possible for black people to be successful.
I'm having a major internal conflict about whether to bring this up, which means I probably should bring it up. And, you know, there are lots of reasons why this will be a problematic example, but just stay with me for a second. So, an obvious thing to look at here is the state of Israel. And,
yeah.
Oh. There are all kinds of problems with the state of Israel, but...
Oh, I'm already formulating in my head right now. This is the wrong comparison, but go ahead.
Well, no, I'm not trying to compare. That's why I said, let's just go with me for a second. So, you know, the impetus for the state of Israel was Theodore Herzl attending a trial where a Jew did not get justice, and ultimately it was determined by not all, but many Jews who ultimately became Zionists, that the only way we're going to be able to ensure that Jews could be citizens who were free and free of persecution would be to have a Jewish state. That's what was done. Now, again, all kinds of problems. It was put in a place where the people already living there were not open to that. But, you know, you asked, Chris, what kind of values? The thing about the state of Israel is there was a very clear mission, which was to create a state that was a safe haven for Jews where they could be prosperous and secure. I don't see a reason why that kind of thinking wouldn't be helpful in improving the life trajectories of black people in the United States. Again, if it would need to be, I think, an autonomous region, but there's no reason why that couldn't be. And then my question back to you, Chris, is Do you see a path to true equity and equality for black people in the United States under the status quo, meaning that there is a diaspora and that and within the United States, and in the aggregate, black people have access to much less wealth, much less in the way of resources?
So your question to me is, can I sketch out a path under the status quo where black people can be more successful and secure in America? And my rebuttal to that is that you concentrating black people into a certain city in the United States is actually no different. It's still black people trying to be safe and secure under the status quo. What you've learned in the Soul City podcast is that this has been attempted. We have black concentration in places like Baltimore, in certain parts of every city in America. If we want to talk about a path to equity, equality, safety, and security, I'm not certain that that would necessarily include concentrating black people in an area. If we were an agrarian economy where it would matter that everyone was together, then maybe that would make more sense. In this information age, if we want to talk about people creating economic opportunity or coming up with really great literature or poetry or something to advance African American culture, I'm not so certain we all need to be in the same place to do that.
See, I found it much more practical than I did when Jason first introduced it. Simply because of the endeavor of Soul City. Because, I mean, I think if you're conceiving it as a kind, maybe, and this is also the challenge, Jason, is if you're conceiving it as this wholly independent space, I think it's very difficult. But, you know, one of the things that happened in many of those communities, all of them failed. All of them failed except one. There were 13 right. intentional communities. All of them failed, and not all of them were black. So, for various reasons. And so I think one of the communities that they said that succeeded was actually one of the communities that were connected and had resources built up. But one of the things that's interesting here is they became, Jason, some of them became incorporated cities or something like that. So I've noticed that some incorporated cities have their own rules, they have their own police force, they have a certain independence that I think could be replicated, and then you could sort of model that. And so for me, that suddenly became sort of exciting and interesting to me, because it's the intentionality of it. That's the exact same point I brought up the last time, which is that we have black concentration and we have many concentrations of different groups of people, but it's always been accidental. There's an intentionality to this that you can sign on for. This is what this community stands for. This is what you are agreeing to participate in. And this is why we are going into this space, you know, and this is what we're going to commit to doing. So I thought that the idea of maybe bringing a group of people with shared values together in that experiment, I don't see anything wrong with that. It probably won't be Black Lannis, though. Do you know what I mean?
What do you mean? What would it be?
I mean, I think it could be possible with a group of people regardless of their ethnic background.
Got it.
Do you know what I mean?
I do want to go back to you, Chris, and just say, you know, I asked the question. you didn't answer it. You simply said why you thought my idea was not necessary. But I do want to ask you again, do you have a vision for how equity might be achieved for black people in the United States?
I feel like I'm Bernie Sanders being interviewed by the New York Daily News. I have not explored legally the implications of my fake policies. No, I don't know if I can. I don't know if I can answer the question. I think that I do, on my sunnier days, see that things in this country might change. But if it's black people moving to a mountain, I don't see that as part of it. I honestly think it's quite the opposite. I think, and I'm not saying that it would deter or it would distract from the goal of equanimity in society, but I don't think black people moving to a mountain or the bottom of the ocean or a golden plain somewhere is going to change things significantly. In fact, I think what moved me in this conversation and the first time we discussed this was the idea of intentionality that Trisha keeps bringing up. If you made an intentional community where you wanted to not just have black people, because I fear that they would create something, if you get too many of one person in an area, they're going to create something that it's not going to be, it's really not going to be too different from where you left. Like you, I think if we had an intentional community where we mix people of all different races, ethnicity, religions, throw in a lot of LGBT people in there, points of view, and then those people would have to figure out how to recreate the society like that, then I think that might be more successful, because at least in that way, it's searching for solutions with the world as it actually is. Moving a whole bunch of black people into the same area and asking them to create a world in reaction to the one that they are trying to leave behind, I think will end up looking very much like the one they left behind. Reference George Orwell's Animal Farm. You know what I mean? So I feel like the intentionality is important, but intentionality around race is not going to work. Just like, forgive me, the intentionality around religion in Israel is not working. Not for a lot of reasons, but like it wasn't a panacea.
Okay, we will agree to disagree again.
Trisha, I'm going to ask you to close up this topic with a simple question. Who's right, me or Jason?
Who's right on this? I think Chris, you're too resistant to it.
Oh, yay. I thought I was going to win that. She said, Chris, I think, and I was like, here we go.
You lose, Chris. There's too much resistance, but can I say something I think would be really fun? Let's keep revisiting this. But
no!
Next time, yes! But next time, I'm giving you an assignment. Next time, I want you to attempt to really answer Jason's question.
Fine. I can answer it. I just give me some time. I'm going to dig through history, and I'm going to answer it. Because I think Jason's vision is extremely limited and ancient.
Okay. So that's fair enough. And I don't want to dismiss you like Bernie. I want you to prove that you don't know what you're talking about. I do like it, though. I do like this. Remember how we always, as friends, we always have these thematic things that we come back to every 4 or 5 years in our friendship.
Yeah. So I guess we'll be visiting, hey, listeners, we'll be visiting this idea every other week. Because that's pretty much been our schedule with Black Lances.
Maybe listeners could give us some sense of what they think is workable about Black Lances and what's not workable about it.
Oh my God, you know what?
Can I tell you what my friend Sarah said about this topic?
No!
She said...
I'm kidding, go ahead.
She said, I couldn't help but think, is Jason trying to send all the black people away?
That's the easy get, right? He's trying to kick it.
This sounds a lot like when black people say go back to Africa. I was like, no, I'm saying you could have Georgia.
No, I'm not living in Georgia. All right, so.
Good point.
Let's move on.
I think my topic could be quite small, so I think it's manageable. We've been running our mouths.
Yeah, why don't you... Yeah, Jason's talked enough. So, Jason, you take a back seat, and Trisha, take it away.
Done. Oh, I'm seated.
Are you taking a back seat? So, Christopher introduced me. It was actually Chris that introduced me to a show some time ago, about maybe what, approximately three seasons ago. It was a show called Sleepy Hollow, and it was on Fox. And his introduction to the show for me was, hey, it's really clever, really interesting, really engaging, and it's got a very diverse cast. You should check it out. I think you said you're not usually into fantastical things, but I think you'd find it really enjoyable.
Just to help you out in your retelling, what I actually said to you was that it was the most diverse cast I've ever seen in a primetime show ever.
At the time. And so I proceeded to watch the show and fell in love with Sleepy Hollow. I fell in love with Sleepy Hollow for all the things that I think are really strong points on the show, which is it's a kooky storyline that has a wonderful mythology. And I love the leads the leads had really great chemistry. The lead actress, Nicole Beharie, is an African-American, and Tom Misson is also a co-lead, and he's a British actor. They had wonderful chemistry on the show. And then I also loved the way that the lead black character was written. I thought that she was written in a way that I hadn't seen on TV in a while, which is that she was tough and soft at the same time. And I liked the world that they created around her family. She had a sister. And it was just really complicated, nuanced, and just really, and also just a fun ride. And I was so shocked that it was on TV and we were able to watch it. Fast forward 3 years, they have killed off the character, the lead character played by Nicole Beharie, and there was quite a bit of massive fan reaction about that killing because it came on the heels of some really disappointing story arcs and some sidelining of the characters that we all found diverse in season one. And then to have the sort of lead actress be killed off the show, even though the actress wanted to go, was sort of the beginning, was just sort of signal that our fears were true, which is that maybe it's impossible for us to have a truly diverse show on TV.
You did a really good job with that summary, but you got from point A to C really quickly because there's something important. I'm going to go back to something I said earlier. When I first told you about the show, I said it was the most diverse show I'd ever seen on TV ever that is not about crime or drugs. It was just it's just a general sci-fi fantasy tale, and you don't normally see black people involved in that on this level. So, Tricia, just to blow up what the middle part of what you're saying is that after the successful first season where they had Nicole Beharie, African-American lead, Tom Misson is the white dude, and then like John Cho was in it for a minute, and then there were a couple Latino actors. After that first season, they added a lot more white characters, and they blew up the part of the male lead's wife, and she was like a damsel in distress, and the show became all about their relationship. It was, and the black woman, who is the lead, took a back seat, so much so that in posters for the show, it was Tom Misson and the woman playing his wife, and she was a minor character in the show, but it was two white faces. To answer your question, though, like, can we actually have a diverse cast on TV? I think so. I really think it's possible. I mean, look at the original Star Trek. I just don't know where those visionaries are today. Like, I'm not sure what the barriers are to that. Jason, what do you think?
Well, we have to mention Shonda Rhimes. Maybe she's the exception that proves the rule, but she's done it multiple times. She's had hit shows with diverse casts. So that's my first thought, is that it's obviously doable. Like so many things, is there the will to do it, to make it a regular occurrence that actually reflects the diversity of our society? I don't know.
See, I think the thing that's interesting about this scenario is that I kind of feel like, even though you have the example of Shonda Rhimes, I think that people think of her as an exception. And so my sense of it is that the showrunners and the people, because the people behind the scenes for this show are all white, mostly. And so I think in a weird way, I mean, there's an article I sent to the team, the two folks, but one of the points that the writer makes is that this had been a model that had been used in the past. It was UPN. But the tradition typically is to sort of bring a show that is new and you're uncertain of how it's going to play and you want to do it cheaply. And so usually what you do is you run with sort of a diverse cast because you can afford to pay those people less. They're maybe unknown. And then once those folks have built you an audience and you now have resources and money, instead of sort of continuing to nurture that talent that you had, you then go after quote-unquote white stars, right? Or more obviously marketable stars. So
why does that make sense? Like, why, like, if the show is successful, like Sleepy Hollow.
Season one was the breakout season. It was. Season two was never as good.
And it got a lot of buzz, so I'm not certain. And this is just general, this is the general question that I'm always wondering about TV and movies. It's like, when you get it right the first time, don't let anybody leave. Like, lock those writers in the room, lock the producers in the room, and tell them to do the exact same thing over again. Now is not the time to make changes. So if you have a show with a really diverse cast and it is a hit and people are responding to it, why would, like, what racist asshole is them being like, oh, great, now let's stick a whole bunch of white people in there because that's really what people want? Well, clearly not. If you believe that these things are worked out in the marketplace, well, the marketplace has spoken.
See, and I think this is what this is my question. The question I was wondering is there something that's sort of internalized in the other? To some degree, I often wonder if that's what's happening. It's like you've gone along and you've believed something. So even though you have the success on your hand, first of all, you haven't decided why you're successful, maybe. Maybe it's confusing to you. Because the interesting thing is, like, everything that worked in season one, they completely threw out in season two. So even, the fan base was like, we love the couple's chemistry. We love the two leads' chemistry.
So
we love
the
sister relation. So then the second season, they completely sidelined the couple, the two of them on screen. They're not on screen often at all. Then, it was just like, it was so aggressively done that this is why I had to raise the question. Like, maybe the desire is not there. And even I don't get it.
I want to put on my tinfoil hat sometimes because when these decisions get made on TV, I'm always like, don't these people want to make money? Isn't that why they got in the business? But maybe they're really in it to advance a point of view, regardless of how much money they can make.
What's interesting to me in this conversation, listening to the two of you, I think what I see is an intersection of two unfortunate things. One is I do think, we could cite lots and lots of examples of success being the leading to the demise of an artist or a piece of art or a model. We were talking, in the last podcast I talked about how bad my Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 was, and Trisha was like, oh, well, the second one's never as good as the first. So I think there is that impulse to say, well, we made it. Let's shake it up. I mean, I can almost hear them saying, what if we now went in a direction of, like, what's with the relationship between the husband and the wife? So yeah. That's one thing. And now what that's intersecting with, which is so prevalent in our society, is when you're doing something new and bold or different or trying to be successful, to your point, Chris, even if the numbers would tell you otherwise, the inclination, because I think of the history of this country and the seeds that have been planted so deeply, is to go white. And even if people aren't conscious of it. Now, I don't know if in this case if they were conscious or not, but the impulse is to go whiter. When you're going to hire more actors, the impulse is to hire white actors. Like that, the system is set up to do that. And if this was a Black Lioness production company, it might be different.
Can I say, I think again, to your point, Jason, I guess this is thematic. It's intentionality, right? Shonda's shows to say...
Yes.
And I sit down and watch, we watch The Catch, right? It's barely related to Shondaland because I think she's like an executive producer, so she's not even like hands-on in it. But we were watching a new show on ABC called The Catch. We keep looking at each other and we're like, oh my God, I can't believe we're watching this show. Because the co-stars sometimes, the extras in a couple of the scenes were two black girls with different hairs. I mean, it was just like, we just kept looking at each other going, this is a world I can see. I can see this world. I see this world in LA. And we've never seen it on TV. And so we're reacting to it. And so I think the thing, though, is that in that world, in Shondaland, it's purposeful. It's an intention. But I think what happened with these folks is that I think they struck up on something and it was accidentally on purpose, which is that they were trying to find possibly good actors who had enough name recognition to kind of generate an audience buzz, which necessarily means that you might be able to get folks of color. Like John Chow, it's like, oh, I know him. Whoever was on John Chow's tier, say as a white actor, would probably command a little bit more, so you couldn't afford, right? So you get John Chow. But then when you make a little bit more money, you go, hey, remember how our original desire was to get this guy? Let's go get him now. So it's like,
I don't know. I'm not certain that that's... I'm responding to what you're saying about Shonda Rhimes and that she purposely creates these worlds where you see people of color in both the foreground and the background because that's what life is actually like. I do think when it comes to... I think it's a synthesis of what both of you are saying, actually, but I don't agree with either of you wholly. They might go into a second season and say, okay, the first season was great. Everybody loves it. I have ideas for making it better. We're going to add 3 new characters and delve into the husband-wife thing, right? Because everyone loves husbands and wives. But in moving in that direction, they need 3 new actors. They have auditions. If they're not purposefully looking for people of color, they're not going to find them. Because at the end of the day,
that's right.
You know, who's going to show up for anything in this country? Mostly it's going to be white people, because there's simply more white people, especially when we talk about industries like that, but run with white people. What I'm trying to say is that they'd have to intentionally, like Shonda Rhimes, intentionally be like, we need to match the people who are coming onto the show with the people who are already on the show. We've created a world,
and
we need to make sure we're pitching to that. But instead, maybe they were like, just tell casting instead of 3 actors. I'm not certain it has anything to do with money, because if this production could afford whoever they could afford, you know, they just made choices.
They couldn't because it was they couldn't the first season. That's what I'm saying. This is the established history that
but
I was talking about.
But the people they added on the second season were not such great stars that they couldn't afford them the first season, or even better people. So I'm not certain that that was the motivation. I think it was just sort of like it was. I don't want to use the word accidental, because, you know, now we're stepping into white supremacy. There's nothing accidental about it. I'm just saying.
But unconscious.
It was unconscious.
Their own unconscious bias.
Yeah, we need 3 new actors. Get us three new actors, and then three white guys walk in.
No, because to your point about sort of unconscious bias and actually being really challenging yourself to be purposeful all the time, I don't know, just a quick aside, the character in Scandal is the white gay man. He and his lover or husband adopted a child, and Shonda said she wanted that child to be black. Do you know what I mean? That was something she consciously wanted to present a story about adoption in a very specific way. Do you know? And so even down to casting choices, there has to be intentionality all the time, you know? And if you sort of fell into it, you can easily fall out of it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Shonda, you know, I'm thinking about Shonda Rhimes as we talk, and you know, what's interesting about her, not only is she intentional about having diverse casts, but there's an even fantastical amount of interracial relationships. Have you noticed that? I mean,
yeah.
Obviously we have interracial relationships in our country, but I mean, on her shows, it is...
If you stroll through Brooklyn, it's all interracial relationships all the time. It's not that fantastical.
It looks very intentional on her shows, the number of interracial relationships that there are, both gay and straight relationships.
Which is sometimes the critique of hers for people. You know, some people think that she doesn't fully celebrate the, you know, black love or whatever,
you
those
know,
things.
Whatever.
But you know, well, no, I'm just saying that just as Jason recognizes it, it's also been a point of contention for some, you know, so that is there. But I get your
I did want to make an observation, though, which is it's something I've thought about before. Lots of black filmmakers, both big screen and small screen, it seems like they often have white characters and not just white. Something that is often the case is that the white characters are like really nice. I find it just very strange. Like the kind of vanilla chips that show up in black films and like really like nice, maybe not so smart, but like really nice white people. It's I don't know what to make of that. Maybe
it's
a topic for another time.
Maybe another topic. But I mean, so do you wanna round out my topic in any way, Christopher? Because you stopped watching the show and you invited me to it. So
I stopped watching the show. I'm sad of where Sleepy Hollow went thematically, but also with the choices that they made in the second season. I was so excited to see this show with all these different people on it. And Gene Roddenberry really hit on something with the Star Trek universe. When he had the vision of the future and having like Russians and Japanese people and African Americans and white people all working together and being the future, it told its own story, right? It created a new universe. And like I said, this show was so diverse, and a show about battling demons and solving mysteries. The fact that black people, Latino people, Asian people, everyone was involved in that, I mean, for the genre, it was sort of,
that might have been an introduction to people, yeah. Like, oh, wow, I can do that too. That's something that I can imagine. Like, I can see a lot of children of color thinking that, because in these sorts of stories, these sorcery and demon stories, usually you see Indiana Jones types or something like that. So I'm really sad that Sleepy Hollow went down that path. And I only hope that going forward, like, we see more intentionality in Shondaland, sure, but also across genres.
Yep.
I think science fiction is doing more of it, because I think people are a lot more conscious that when they show visions of the future, that they, it just can't all be white people. They tried to correct that in Star Wars, and people freaked out by having, like, a black character in it. But it's like, yes, if we're talking about planets full of people and they're all supposed to be white people, like, what are you trying to say? So I think now people with science fiction, they're a little bit more intentional about it. But I'd like to see that move across genre. Children's Brain does a good job of it, usually. Uh-huh. But I'd like to see that in our movies and on TV more. So,
that's so what for I'm any of our listeners, if you watch...
Go out there and make your own TV shows, listeners. That's what
I'm saying. If you watch Sleepy Hollow, I'd love to hear what your impressions of it, whether you stuck with it throughout the seasons. We stopped. Conscious decision.
Yeah, so call us on the phone and let us know. So I'm going to just jump into my topic, which is, I don't know if we had discussions or rants today. Mine's a bit of a rant. So I was just talking to a colleague recently, and she's a woman, and we got into a conversation just about the pressures that she feels as a woman who owns her own business and has a family, and sort of how she can reconcile all of that and how it was really, really hard. I got to thinking to a interview that Indra Nooyi, who is the CEO of Pepsi, had last year. And in that interview, I was shocked by her pragmatism around this question. The interview asked her, do you think women can have it all? And she said, no, pretty much no. What she was saying was that she had made choices to get to be the CEO of Pepsi, and if we had asked her children, she said that she didn't think her children would say she's a very good mother, that she's not there for homework time, that if her daughter wants to play Nintendo, she has to call the office and talk to the secretary, who goes through a checklist of things that the child needs to have done, and if the child reports that she's done all of it, then the secretary gives her permission to play Nintendo. Like,
And sends an email to her documenting the conversation.
Okay. And so part of me was like, I'm a big student of the different phases of feminism, because in a lot of ways I think it's a movement that went wrong. In that,
shit.
I don't think so. I think in a lot of ways. Like,
lots of movements went wrong.
Lots of movements are wrong, but the feminist movement, one of the waves was all about we want what men have. We want what men have. And I didn't think that really respected women as women. And I think that was the mistake, because men were like, oh, you want what we have? Okay, fine. We'll let a few of you be CEOs. And now, you know what we do? We work weekends, and we don't go home, and we don't give a shit about our kids, and we let everything fall by the wayside. Here you go, ladies. And then the women were like, oh, wait a minute. We don't want what men have. We want choices. And that's a different sort of thing. I guess my question to you guys is, do you think women can have it all? What do you think? Tricia, you're a woman. Do you have it all yet? Jason, ladies first. Please, Jason. This is exactly the kind of patriarchal bullshit I'm talking about, Jason. That you try to go
it's
first.
Important. I am going to tell you how you should think about this, Tricia.
Tricia, ignore Jason's misogynist bullshit. Tricia, what do you think?
I've thought about this a lot. Not necessarily because I'm a single woman, and I wouldn't necessarily call myself having a massive career. I think I have a modest career. Those have been intentional choices. And it's something I've had to come around to recognizing. It's hard for me because I then read your background piece. You also sent us a this wonderful Why Women Still Can't Have It All article in The Atlantic, and I actually made my way through it. So some of the points.
Oh my God! Can the Atlantic just have a word limit? It could be 50,000, but just some word limit.
I printed that out, and it was 26 pages long.
Yeah,
my battery died reading that damn article.
Oh, yeah, double sided. No, you're right. Double sided. I was like, shit. I think we already got. The reality is that if you don't change society, if mm-hmm. you don't recognize that policies and structures have to change to support women's we never recognize that women's entry into the workforce would necessitate that things have to change at the workplace. It's kind of like in the 80s when women started wearing suits, but it was like boxy suits that were like sort of pseudo men's.
I knew you were
suits.
Gonna say that.
You know what I mean? And it was like, I'm just gonna wear a suit that a man would wear, but I'm gonna put it's got a little twist on it. It's gonna be a skirt suit. I mean, and if you remember, the woman, the lean-in writer, she talked about how, you know, she was trying to negotiate, I think an early chapter in her book, she's negotiating sort of parking as a pregnant woman, and she wanted to keep the parking the exact same way or some element of that, because she just didn't want anyone to think that she needed any sort of crutch. And I was sitting there thinking to myself, you're pregnant and you need to park closer. That's a change that needs to be instituted, you know? So it was like, there was always this kind of defensive measure on the woman's side, like, I'm not going to ask for anything, nothing at all. Please don't even ask, give me separate bathrooms if need be, you know? And it was just sort of, and it was, I mean, it is interesting that there was a kind of failure to recognize that systems and structures would need to be changed. Because those structures were inherently patriarchal or maybe sexist in their construction. But that's like the larger thing that I always keep in mind. But for me personally, I've always just assumed that it was always on me to make these choices because society structures weren't going to change. So if I wasn't willing to work 80 hours a week, I wasn't going to make it to certain places in the company. I just always kind of knew that.
So Jason,
I never really thought getting it all. In that way.
So Jason, do you think that's a fair thing that society asks of women? Sort of like, oh, this is the way to success, and ladies, you can choose the success. Is that wrong? Is it possible for women to do both?
I think there's so much wrapped up in this. It's a really loaded issue.
So much. Oh, it's a loaded question. I just wanted to be as provocative as possible.
Yeah, no, well, I would start with, let's even back away from the gender disparity for a second and just say, how many people in society have everything, have it all, quote unquote?
Yeah. Well, what does it all mean? Like, when I say it all, what are you even hearing?
No, but that's what I mean. So, I'm kind of a student of Buddhism and Kabbalah and, like, you know, these spiritual traditions that say that we have this fundamental desire for more, whatever that is. For some people, it's more prestige, it's more sex, it's more kids, it's a better relationship with our kids, it's, you know, it's money. We all have that drive to always want more. It's a really, just fundamentally, it's a question that I think for 99% of the population is no. Like, no one can have it all because you always want more. Now, that's like at the most fundamental level. The next level up, I would say, is I think that part of why this is difficult is something fundamentally problematic about our economy and our society. You know, when women entered the workforce in large numbers, you know, what happened for a period of time, families had higher income, but gradually that kind of bottomed out. You know, I do think you can see this in the same frame of like, well, the 1% got wealthier and wealthier with more people entering the workforce. It didn't necessarily mean that families got wealthier. They had higher income for a while, but now, again, we've seen that kind of run its course. So I think that there is a rat race that many of us are stuck in where we're working, and we're trying to be good parents. I think that when you have a couple where both parents are working full-time, which is the norm now, I think it's very difficult to attend to the kids as well as either the father or the mother might like to. I can certainly speak from personal experience about how hard that is, and I know other families that feel the same way. So I think that there's a lot at play here. There's like human nature, there are like problems in our economy and inequity. So sorry for that lengthy background. But then after all of that, you know, I don't think anyone can have it all. And I think that women and all people need to ask themselves, what do they feel most fulfilled doing? I mean, the CEO of Pepsi, she clearly has made a choice. And I really respected that she was candid about that. She has chosen career. Not to say she doesn't love her kids or she doesn't take care of them to some extent, but again, I mean, she was being, I think, very candid that, like, it's nothing to celebrate that her secretary is the one giving permission to her kid to play a video game. Mm-hmm. You can't have it all. And so I think you got to figure out what you're most excited and passionate about, and then those other things you're responsible for, you do your best to make sure those responsibilities are fulfilled. For me, my kids come first, but I do work a lot, and I don't always feel good about that balance.
So the article that we, the Atlantic article / book that we were talking about was Why Women Still Can't Have It All in the Atlantic by, I think her last name is Slaughter, Anne Marie Slaughter. And in that she talks a lot about just how women sort of shrink in these situations, and they don't want to ask too much, and they don't want to make it seem like they need quote-unquote special treatment because they're women, even though, you know, they may be primarily responsible for their kids, or they may be pregnant, as Trisha brought up, and they don't want to ask for special, quote-unquote special consideration. But what she suggests at the end of the article is really just, we need to change the way that we think about work in society in general. You shouldn't have to ask for leave when your kid's born. Everyone should just get it automatically. And that way we don't set up a system whereby some people can decide that they're not going to take advantage of these things, or they are, and it's going to look a certain way. You know what I mean? I think there needs to be more of that. I do think, Jason, even though I posed you the question, I'm going to be critical of what you said.
Great.
Yeah, I know. I set you up completely, and now I'm going into...
I want to criticize someone. Let me ask Jason a question.
Jason, you're so fun to criticize. But
Thank you.
I start off by saying earlier, no one, like men who are at the top of the corporate ladder, they also made a choice, right? So, because those are the guys who were never around for their kids. And now women who want access to... not necessarily those lifestyles, but they want access to those choices and those levels of supervision and management. Now that women are coming up behind, I don't think it's fair to ask women to make the choice. I don't think it was fair to ask men to make the choice. I think instead of people working 80 hours a week, we should have said, what's the value of working 80 hours a week if your kids are at home, whatever, having to fend for themselves or being full-time nannies. In the Slaughter article, she talks a lot about how some man was being lauded, I think it was a memorial, and his son stood up and said that even though his dad was never around, he understood that was the price he paid for helping so many people and doing his job so well. And the kid kind of accepted like that, well, that's what success is. Like, he was successful even though I didn't really know who he was. And there's like a disconnect, like a weird dissonance about that, which I think we can avoid just by really thinking about our structures. And yes, I'm advocating like a completely different society, but here we are.
I agree with everything you said, Chris. I don't disagree with that at all. And what I didn't mention with kind of the structural causes of this problem is around education, which is we have an education system in a society that's set up to create a pyramid and perpetuate a pyramid. And it's a couple people at the top who have a ton of power, and exercising that power and building more power is what they do 23 hours a day. I was reading those articles and I'm like, why do they have to work so much? Why can't they have like a really robust leadership team that takes on more responsibility? And it's funny because I was coming from a board meeting of a nonprofit where it's a similar conversation we're having, where it's like, wow, people at the top are working really hard. I agree, Chris, like, we need to really rethink some structures, because I think our society is built on this kind of pyramid model where we don't invest enough in a large enough number of people to be leaders in organizations and to distribute leadership adequately.
There's also people who are attracted to power. You know, I think that's one of the things that I appreciated about your comment, Jason, is recognizing that there's a kind of human nature element to it too, which is that there is a drive in some of these people to be at the top of a pyramid. they like a pyramid structure.
That's true.
And so this idea of even like a shared leadership, because that's one of the things that the article also introduced, the last article you're talking about, Chris, it introduced all sorts of notions about how we might be able to change the workplace, which is how, which is maybe people don't have to have a lot of face time anymore. You know, maybe there's a, maybe we could construct a space where people are working 3 days at an office and 2 days at home. I mean, we can actually loosen up some of those expectations. But I've often thought that about even jobs themselves. Like, I'm always like, wouldn't it be fun to have like a sort of job sharing and seasonal? Like, I only want to work in the fall and the spring. How about you and I trade? You know what I mean? I just think that
Trisha,
actually...
you are ready to vote for Bernie. That's what this is about.
Right?
You have flipped on Bernie.
Always,
you are always. You are speaking the gospel.
I'm speaking, but I just think, you know, I think it's, I mean, and I think there is this notion too that we're still trapped in a kind of agrarian model of how we've constructed the world, and we haven't moved out of it. Like, we've constructed sort of career paths that work against the way the female reproductive system works, right? You're supposed to be establishing your career in your 20s. Well, honey, that's when my eggs are good. So, I should probably, so just, I mean, just sort of we're kind of anti-human, the way we've constructed our society.
That's true.
And then, yeah, and then we sort of push back on people because we're saying it's up to you now to make a better choice. I've made it impossible for you to succeed.
Yes, exactly, right?
You know what I mean? You want to have babies in your 20s? Well, guess what? You have to make a career happen. Why can't I make my career happen in my 40s? You know,
exactly.
I've had more world experience.
It's so true. So true.
So,
now,
I mean,
that,
is...
now that the men have decided how to get to success, now the women can't be like, what's wrong with you?
But I do think that now that women enter the workplace, I think there's now the possibility of a dialogue as well, right? There can be a dialogue about how both groups of people could have what they want, right? Because, I mean, I think you're completely right, Chris. I never understood why anybody thought the disappeared father was a good idea.
but we're just comfortable with it because that's the way society's set up. Like, it's patriarchal, and men are the breadwinners, and women are at home keeping the home, and we're very comfortable with that. So many people grew up never seeing their fathers. When I was little, I thought my dad was Richard Pryor because they looked kind of similar. And this is a true story, and he was never home. And I was like 5 years old, and I remember my mom getting a picture of my dad and showing it to me, like, no, this is your dad, because I never saw him.
Because he's Jamaican. And
yeah, and he had six jobs. And that's a real problem, but mom was always home. You know, that's it doesn't
you know what's interesting? You know what's interesting, though? I do believe that there was a time when men at the top of the pyramid didn't work that hard. You think about old money and feudalism, they were like on the golf course. Like, they still weren't there for their kids. They just were sleeping with their mistresses and smoking cigars with their buddies. And I don't know. It's I don't know. The kids always get the short end of the stick. That's the bottom line.
Well, because kids have always been seen as like the women's sphere. So it's like, okay, men, we're all CEOs and we have the halls of power. And women are like, let us in. And the men look at them and they think, who's going to take care of the kids? And the women are like, why the fuck is that my problem? They're your kids.
But, you know, I mean, it all comes full circle because, you know, we pat men on the back when they, like, have their kids and they're like, they're babysitting. I'm like, no, they're there.
That's our father.
They're there.
But it raises
question about construction. This construction of society is really why women can't have it all and why no one can have it all.
Well, we need to deconstruct it. Someone mentioned Bernie Sanders because apparently this is a podcast about Bernie Sanders. But maybe we talk about that man every goddamn week. I cannot wait for this election.
Everyone loves him, though. All of your
but
friends
anyway,
in the timeline love him.
Hey, I haven't mentioned Trump the whole time.
Oh, so and on that note, we're ending this topic so we can get to it. So let's talk about our recommendations. Has there been a media event that you saw, read, experienced this week that you think other people should see, read, or experience? Or if you are oppositional like Jason, is there something that you saw, read, experienced that you think other people should not see, read, or experience? Let's talk about those things now. Trisha, let's start with you.
I mean, this is sort of weird. It's related to my topic, but and even though I'm angry, I still want everyone to understand why I was angry. So I would totally recommend Sleepy Hollow season one. You don't even need season. You don't need the continuation. But I just want you to understand the world that we were excited by. So I'm gonna recommend season one of Sleepy Hollow.
You know, I don't have a media event, but what I would like to recount is that on my way back to my apartment to participate in this podcast, I was in a rush and I was starving. It was 8:30 at night. I hadn't eaten in many, many hours. And so I stopped by this place in D.C. called Ann Pizza. It's a chain, kind of like the Chipotle of pizzas, but it's so good. So I'm recommending Ann Pizza.
Never mention Chipotle of pizza because that means that someone's going to get sick. So, poor Chipotle.
I didn't mean that.
Jason... You have one task during this segment. You know what I mean? Like, you have one thing to do. Like, recommend freaking meeting. But, like, you every week you come and you're like, screw that.
I love the pizza. I love the pizza recommendation.
Who sent the topic first? I did. I can't do it all, Chris. Just like women in the workforce with kids, I can't fucking do it all. I set the topic before you two. You set the topic 5 minutes before the damn podcast and you're on my shit about this damn recommendation.
You know what, Jason?
You were called out, Christopher. Can't even help yourself. Look at you. Slayed.
Jason, next week, I'd like you to do the work, okay? Thanks.
Can you send out a topic before 5 minutes before the podcast? Okay. Is that possible? You send out two articles, which together are 3,000 pages. 5 minutes before
half
the
an
podcast.
Hour before. Half an hour before.
I didn't have enough battery life to read them.
Oh my God, I love it. Jason basically told you.
Okay, so I don't know if anyone's current on Scandal. Scandal has sucked the last season and a half. But I seriously enjoyed the last episode, which I think is called, the subtitle of it is called Thwack. It really takes Olivia Pope to a different level. And I haven't been that excited or shocked watching Scandal in like 2 years. So if you bounced off of Scandal, you could probably stay off. But check out this episode because you're going to be like, what the hell? So... that was my recommendation.
Check out the episode to confirm why you dropped Scandal in the first place.
I know, right?
How did he end up here?
I know. Well, you know, she was trying to have it all, and that's what you have to do. All right, guys. Well, this has been an exciting podcast, and so everyone have a great night, and I guess I'll talk to y'all next time.
Bye.
Have a great night.
Thanks. Bye.